In this week's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with coach and educator Dominic Kuza. Dominic is also involved in product innovation and education at Revive Raw Relive. Dominic and I speak about what supplements he recommends for about anybody, but are also particularly those going through perimenopause and menopause, misunderstood principles when it comes to training programming, and more. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Dominic, and please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Dominic. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with coach, educator Dominic Kuza, who's also a product involved in product development and education for the companies Revive, Raw, and Relive. Dominic, welcome to the show. I'm super excited to speak with you today.
Thank you for having me on.
It's my absolute pleasure, and I'd love to just kick off with a little bit of an intro about you, how you got into coaching, and what brought you to doing a master of in exercise science, and so on. If you can just give us a little bit of a background, that would be great.
Yeah, so I played soccer most of my life, and then so I was always in athletics, always interested in the weight room and stuff, and was in school for I was pursuing dentistry. And decided to take a turn and go into exercise science. Really, what got me into like bodybuilding at first, because that's where my fitness career started, was just Instagram. I saw the way some of these guys looked, and I thought, like, man, that'd be really cool. Like, it's obviously achievable if they can do it. So that's what kind of drew me to that. And then I got interested in bodybuilding, started competing myself. And that kind of took the turn for all of what happened with like schooling. I didn't really care for dental school anymore. And then I wanted to shift, did a post-bachelor and then went to my master's program. So that was kind of how the thing got started. And it's been ever since.
Amazing. Well, that's a pretty cool journey, although I can imagine your parents at first might not have been too happy about ditching dental school.
No, they were not thrilled about that.
But I'm sure by now they're content with what you're doing, as long as you're content.
Yeah. I'm Middle Eastern. I'm Iraqi. So like in an ethnic household, you know, parents are very like school. They want you to be a doctor, a pharmacist, a dentist, a lawyer, something like that. So when I came home, it was like, I don't think I'm going to do this. They're like, what do you mean? I mean, it was like full blown intervention. Like, cousins calling me, aunts calling me. Are you sure you're okay?
Oh, that's hilarious. I spent a little bit of time in Dubai, and I do have a few clients like Iran, Iraqi type of areas. And so I know a little bit about the culture, and I can absolutely imagine that.
Yeah, it's intense. So now everything's fine now.
Awesome. Well, I'm happy to hear that. And where I want to start really is kind of a little bit in the product development and education for the companies that you work for. Also in that realm, just in the sense of, A, what's in the works? What are you guys working on? What are you passionate about in there in the product development side? But also I have a sort of sub question to that. And that would be, if someone has $100 to spend on supplements per month, and I want to make sure that we're prefacing this, that yes, we probably agree that whole foods are the best and you should get a lot of your micronutrients, etc., from that, but we also know that we can only achieve optimal nutrition really with a few supplements here and there. So if someone only has, quote unquote, only has $100 per month, what would you spend that on?
Oh man, so I would say $100 a month on supplements. I think the most important would be a good, like, essential fatty acids, like a good source of omega-3s. I think vitamin D, I would say probably 60% of the population is insufficient in vitamin D. So those would be two. I would actually lump up creatine in there. Even if you weren't like somebody who trained a ton, there's, you know, a lot of benefits of creatine outside of just training. And if your meat consumption is not high, you're probably not getting enough in the day. So I would say creatine would be one I would actually add to that. And a lot of females actually freak out a little bit when you mention creatine, because it's always associated with water retention. But, it, you know, if we go low dose, 2 grams, 3 grams a day, That would be like a good amount for you, but you probably wouldn't see a lot of those issues like with a higher creatine intake. So I'd put creatine in that list as well. I would also put like a magnesium supplement, just because we deplete magnesium really easily throughout the day. So making sure that magnesium is being replenished somehow. I'd say that right there, that's probably going to be around like $60. If I had to pick like some other like maybe a little bit higher like shelf ones, I'd say like a good curcumin would be a nice product to have in every day. And then I'd probably also put like a daily greens type supplement, because not everybody eats their fruits and vegetables. So that would probably all lump up about $100 worth.
Awesome. No, that's a very good answer. And then backtracking to that first part of the question where I'm just curious about what's in the works, what are you guys developing, or what are you
Yeah.
currently doing?
So with the Revive side, so Revive is a health supplement company. They're owned by Dom Icavone and Matt Jansen. And they also own Raw Nutrition alongside like Chris Bumstead. Now with Revive, I work a lot heavily on the product development side and formulations. So we have a sleep product coming out actually by the end of the month that is phenomenal. I got my hands on it early, and my Whoop sleep tracking has gone progressively better every since I started taking it. It's just a mix of magnesium and inositol and glycine, so there's no like melatonin in it or
Oh, I love
anything.
that. Yeah.
So I think it's a phenomenal product. It's my data is actually just continuously getting better. So that's coming out probably by like September time. That'll be out and launched. And then we have a couple other products that are coming. We have a joint product that's going to be coming out in November. We have a product that is going to be really focused on longevity. It's going to be a higher expensive product, but it is going to be something that is focused on like NAD production. It's going to be focused on all of your antioxidants like fistatin, cherry tart, things like that, for just longevity, like biohacking kind of fun that people are really interested in, like medicine 3.0 style supplement. So those are some that are coming out right now. And then our collagen is out now, but we just changed that from marine source to grass-fed cow source,
Interesting.
which gives you a little bit more of type 1 and 3. So you're getting a little bit better of a spectrum of your collagen type there. So that's really good. It mixes really well. It tastes really good. So everyone's been liking that so far since that's come out. But those are kind of like the ones that will be here probably the soonest.
Okay, awesome. I'm curious what's in the joint support one in particular. Can you share
Yeah,
just
we have so like hyaluronic acid, we have UC2, we have Selegrin, which is a patented ingredient. There is going to be some glucosamine, MSM, and then we also have a curcumin standalone coming out. So it's just going to be the C3 complex by itself. That way we can still support and have just a curcumin standalone, because like I said earlier, I think that's a really good standalone to have. But yeah, the joint support is going to be a really good one. It's also designed to be taken like full dosed or half dosed. So like you're in, no matter what serving size you choose, you're within the clinical effective ranges of a lot of the ingredients. So if you're somebody who's training a ton and you need a lot of support, you could take the full serving. Or if you're somebody that wants to just use it for like maintenance, you could take half the serving.
okay, awesome. I have a backup question to my previous one with the $100. I know this is maybe not necessarily your target clientele, but I work a lot with perimenopausal women or menopausal women, etc. So if you had, or if you ha yeah, if you had the ability to add a couple of extra supplements for someone going
Yeah.
through kind of perimenopause or menopause, what would that be?
I would say a B complex, methylated preferably, just so that we're supporting methylation cycles with like B6, B12, and just regulating like homocysteine. I think every woman should take a B complex just to start. I could put that out there. I think it's something that is crucial, very important. a lot of nutrition is lacking to where you probably need a little bit of support there. And not even just the perimenopausal, but even in just reproductive age, I think it's good to have, because if for any reason you were to get pregnant and not have sufficient folate intake, you know, that's something that, is it going to be detrimental? Probably not. But is it going to be beneficial? Probably, because the neural tube is dependent on a lot of that folinic acid, right? So, and that's happening very crucially right at the beginning of that pregnancy. So I do think a B complex is something that like females should consider taking and consider being on. I do suggest like folinic acid, not like folic acid. Folinic acid is like, you could get that specifically. That would be like as close to what is nutritionally in your food, which is folinic acid. I would put DIM in that category, just a support, you know, phase one methylation, phase one like detox of estrogen, but also DIM can also help against like estrogen receptors. So if you can reduce some activity there, maybe you can, you know, reduce some of your symptoms that you're dealing with. I think calcium deglutarate would be a good one to add in there, because, you know, just we're so used to looking at estrogen detox in phase one, phase two, and phase three. You can skip phases and go from phase one to phase three, or phase two to phase three. So supporting both phase one and phase two would be ideal at the same time to just have really good detox pathways, which could make that estrogen a lot easier to get rid of. So I would say like a DIM and CDG combo would be really good. And that's actually pretty cheap. That's actually not that expensive of a product that's out there. Jarro sells one. It's just DIM and CDG together. And that's a really good combo of a supplement to take as so I would lump those into like a perimenopausal. Chasteberry you could also put in there too, because a lot of the issue with menopause is the fluctuations of FSH and LH. Chasteberry acts on the pituitary gland to help regulate that. So I would also put I'd also put chasteberry in there. And if you want to add another, you could put inositol, like a myo inositol would be great.
I'm a huge fan of that for many reasons. Also women having PCOS or just like insulin resistance or blood sugar management.
Yeah, I think inositol is one of the most sleeper supplements out there. Mm-hmm. There's so many times where I'm recommending it, and I mentor a lot of coaches, and one thing that I'll be like, okay, yeah, do this inositol, do this. And one, they were like, dude, you put this with everything. And I said, it's that good. Like, it has a very wide range of dose usage for specific things, and it works really well for a lot of different things. It helps with sleep, it helps with mood, it helps with blood sugar, it helps with myo-inositol has been studied to impact ovarian function. So it's got a wide range you could use it for, and it's a relatively cheap ingredient.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So thank you so much. That was very insightful. I do want to shift gears a little bit into the training area, because I know that you're very proficient in that as well. And as the listeners here know, I am very much focused on my delt and glute development, have been for quite some time. And I think most or many women are that kind of want to train like a bikini competitor.
Yeah.
But maybe aren't. And of course, we know like the standard exercises like lateral raises and hip thrusts and so on. But I am curious if you have any particular exercises that you like for the development of those two muscle groups, especially.
For the delts, I think women don't press enough. I do think pressing is very beneficial for building a delt. I think with pressing, either types of machines are probably best, right? Because your shoulder joint is the most vulnerable joint, because it moves in all planes of motion. So being a little bit more fixed in a machine is probably better and safer. But I do think women don't press with their shoulders enough, and I think there's a lot of development left on the table without that. Because with a lateral raise, you know, there's only so much you could load until it's now you're breaking form or recruiting your traps too much. So I do think having some movement that you can load pretty well is necessary for good growth and good stimulation. So I do think shoulder presses would be one that I would I would have all my females doing. It's in all their programs, so they all press. You know, if that's something that we really need to develop, they do press a lot.
I love that, and especially also because with lateral raises, what I often hear is, I'm maxing out on, 10 or 12 reps with this and that dumbbell. Like it's starting to feel easy, but if I use the slightly lower one, it's too hard for that amount of reps. And so, because the increments are just a little bit are not ideal sometimes. So I think that's a really great point, for shoulder pressing instead.
Yeah, I think shoulder pressing. I also think upright rows, when done correctly, can be great medial delt builders and developers. When I learned how to do a good upright row, is that was actually from I'm good friends with Jared Feather from Renaissance Periodization, and he showed me how to really do an upright row. And once I learned how to do it the way he showed me, which it's on their YouTube, you could just search it. It just like opened up all I could feel was my medial delt after that. So I think that's a great movement as well. And then for the glutes, I mean, I think glutes are ones that can handle a lot of frequency. So I've always been a fan of frequency for growth of specific areas. I'm a big fan of CAS bridges. I think CAS bridges work really well. But I do think a regular hip thrust is necessary too, just to have like a full range of motion, and then you could train it in the partial range of motion with the CAS bridge. I love single leg stuff. Most of my athletes do a lot of unilateral stuff more than they do like just you know 2 legs at the same time. I think split squats are great. I think lunges are great. I think those are again sleeper movements that are usually done wrong, and that's why you don't feel them as much. Where like I'll get videos from people doing a lunge or a split squat that's supposed to be very glute focused, but their knee's traveling too forward, right? So we have to fix that and get that corrected. So those are some of the ones that I really like. And then I picked up some from Alex Bush, like curtsy lunges, things like that. Also just doing like your leg raises a certain different like certain angles is really good for like glute med. I like the way he's taught that a lot too.
Also, I'm not familiar with how he's teaching that. Is that with the maybe like a little bit on a 45-degree angle?
Yeah, and you kind of like swing your leg out and up. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Yeah, that makes sense. And I really like the emphasis on unilateral stuff. Also, just for better mind-muscle connection, but also to keep imbalances out or address imbalances. I have to say that I recently learned from videoing myself also that my hips, when I tended to do like step-ups or so, one side of the hips would always kind of like dip down because one side is weaker than the other. Yeah, it requires a lot of focus to get rid of that.
Yeah. And that's just a compensation issue from doing something wrong for so long.
100%. So I along the training side also, I'm curious what your stance is on squats, especially if someone is mostly focused on hypertrophy. Is that something that is a lot in your training programs, or perhaps as you guide a lot of competitors also, will you keep that in all the way until competition, or kind of taking that out more and exchanging it for isolation ex exercises towards the end?
Yeah, so I love squats. I love squats in multiple variations. I always like to make sure they're doing some sort of hack squat. A Smith squat, I'm a big fan of. I barbell squat a lot now, but my athletes, I don't really have them do too many barbell squats, just because there's if they're not that if their training age is not that old, it's hard for them to recognize what they're doing wrong and why it's feeling a certain way. Whereas like with a Smith, it's a little bit easier for them to recognize that. And then like it just gets easier to recognize that as you go from like barbell to Smith to hack to machine. But I do have squat variations in everybody's plans. I do like them a lot. I really don't change training a whole lot during competition prep, because like my squats are, you know, squats are very high fatigue training movements. So I look at my high fatigue training movements as the ones I probably want the least volume in, so that we're not accumulating too much fatigue that ends up hurting us later in the training session. So for them, It's not so much that we're taking it out. I might change like a Smith squat to like a machine squat so that there's like less warm up time. Because towards the end of preps, like people are, they want to get out of, they want to get in and out of the gym. So the less warm up time, usually the better. So I'll move things that are maybe taking them a long time to warm up with to ones that would be a little bit faster to warm up with. But other than that, I keep training pretty much the same all the way through. Like I have people getting ready for North Americans, which is a week from like tomorrow. And they asked me like, oh, what am I doing? And I'm like, you're not change, just train. Like, just keep training the way you've been training. Your body is so rhythmic at that point that really big shifts could actually kind of negate and be negative for you.
I like that. No, that's cool. And I think at that stage, it's probably also about the mental side of things, keeping things simple and just keeping, like you say, sticking with the routine, reducing that mental load. So no, thank you. That's a great insight. And I know that you are probably training more with advanced athletes or obviously competitors being a little bit more advanced, but we also have a few, several listeners, I would say that all they have is 3 times per week, 60 minutes maybe, where they can train. I would be curious what exercises you would put in there and what kind of split, if any, you would do with a 3 day program.
Yeah. So half my business is lifestyle people. So I get it for sure. That's actually why I started coaching before competitors. But the way I would like to do that, if I only had like 3 days with somebody, it would be like an upper lower for two of them. And then that third one would be like, what do you want to grow the most for them and see what that has to be? Because that would be the most enjoyable. I've realized that's a huge thing that a lot of coaches miss on. Is you have to make it also really enjoyable for the people who don't have like these big aspirations. So I would say like an upper lower, and I would kind of just even the volume across body parts. So like an upper day would just maybe be like two chest, two back, two shoulder, two arms, and then you're done. Now with people who don't have a ton of time in their week to train a lot, I do think putting more volume for them works a little bit better because that relative effort or how close they are to training a failure isn't that high, right? They're not able to take themselves to that point. So more volume maybe can close that gap that we have. I've always noticed that people who can't take themselves to that failure point needed more volume to see growth. So I would probably do more volume for these people too. And then the lower day would be, you know, something really focused on a lot of like leg presses and split squat stuff. The squats would be good. I think they're important for like, you know, the beginner and the average like gym goer to develop stability, like, you know, muscle awareness. But I also think the risk of injury is a little high. So I would rather them do things that are a little bit safer that they also feel a little bit more comfortable doing because I know their effort level is going to be a little bit better. So that's kind of my thoughts like with people like that.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. I think, and the point that you mentioned in the very beginning, in the sense of adherence and also like enjoyment, is absolutely underlooked. Yeah, like, oh, here's the most optimal program. Well, you can't follow that for longer than 2 or 3 weeks, so it's not really optimal.
Yeah, it's not. And also to, you know, to speak to that demographic of people, like you, the younger you are in your training age, the less customized of a program you probably need, right? Because your body's not at the point where it needs such a specific stimulus to grow as if you've been training for 10 years, right? The more advanced of a trainee you are, the more personalized, customized program you actually need, which is like hard to explain to people at first because then they're like, well, what am I getting? Just a basic program? It's not that you're getting a basic program. You're getting the program that you're probably going to respond the most to. Because if I were to make this crazy customized for you, you might not grow the way you think you're going to grow.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we always want to work with the, well, in terms of training, with the optimal adaptable volume as well. So if you're way overshooting it from the beginning in terms of volume, then that leading to injuries or just like overdoing it straight away. There is absolutely, we want to leave something in the tank. So, you did mention intensive training intensity or failure, training to failure later earlier. So I'm curious because there is more and more research coming out, and a little bit is contradictory in the sense of how close to failure we should or need to actually push ourselves. So in your training programs, what sort of intensification description do you work with? Is it percentages? Is it RPE, RIR? What do you use?
So for a long time, I programmed RIR. But then I started to realize people weren't growing the same way that they were when I wasn't. And I think a lot of that, I don't think RIR is flawed. I think people's performance of RIR is flawed. Because I would get videos of clients that were supposed to be doing like a 2 RIR set. And I'd be like, dude, this is like a 5 RIR. Like, and it's hard for the average person to gauge how many more reps they actually have until they were going to fail. That's where I think RIR is, it has its issue, but I think it's super effective if the person knows how to do that. So for what I do now is I put everything to 0 RIR, but their instruction is to go until their last rep is a grinder. So it's not a complete fail, but it's to where you had to all of a sudden your rep speed slowed down 70%, right? And that's where I want you to stop. So I would say that's roughly about a 1 RIR is where most people I have training at. I'm not instructing people to train until the machine falls on you, just because, again, a lot of people can't take themselves mentally to that place. And also they don't, some people just don't feel as safe, so they won't do it. So I would say that's where I usually am putting people. Now, for like the newer gym goer, I wouldn't do that. It would be more of, here's more sets for you, but I might start to add like drop sets or rest pauses or supersets, things that can intensify the movements without failure being associated to it. Because I do think they also need some sort of intensity, right? Because at the end of the day, you growing is you evolving to something, right? So if it's not getting any harder, then you're probably not going to really adapt and change. So a way to help them is with drop sets, supersets, things like that.
That's a really great point. I like that. And especially when we're focused on hypertrophy, those things come in so handy. But to touch on what you said before that with the intensity and reps in reserve, I do think there is a lot of merit to encourage people from time to time to push to failure from time to time, as especially on isolation exercises, exactly because of the point that you mentioned that it's so hard to differentiate between, oh, this is an 85% hard or like an 8 RIR or a 9 RIR. Like we just think this feels hard. It's still gonna feel hard at six if you have 5 reps in reserve versus 2. So occasionally pushing ourselves at least very, very close to failure or to that grinder that you're talking about. If I think of my clientele, at least on average, people are probably not pushing themselves hard enough. I know there is a different demographic where you probably have to pull them back from time to time and just say like, right, we need to manage our intensity a little bit more. But generally speaking, I think from time to time, pushing close to failure is definitely advantageous.
Yeah, no, I agree for sure. And some of the best research now is like, it doesn't even matter how many reps you do, as long as it's, or I shouldn't say that. It's too low of reps, or it's still an issue. But it's, if you take somebody doing 6 to 8 or 15 to 20, their rate of growth is almost the same as long as it's taken to failure. So, because there's people who like training high reps, there's people who like training low reps. It's just trying to find that person's point where they can actually get to that failure point is where I think a lot of it becomes important.
That's a really good take-home training message for sure. Yeah, I want to close the loop a little bit and go back to the nutrition slash supplement side. So I can imagine if you also work with a lot of Gen Pop and probably with competitors also, that you also deal with constipation issues,
Oh,
digestive
yeah.
issues of any kind of sort. So my first question there is, what dietary strategies do you like to implement or do you look at first? But then also, what kind of supplements perhaps you use to aid with that?
Yeah, so let's go nutrition first. What I like to do is look at their diet and look at the total food volume of the diet, because I think that's where some people mess up. Some people get constipated, but their total food volume is still pretty high. So bulking their stool sometimes isn't a good idea. It actually can make them more constipated, because everyone thinks just fiber right away when they're constipated. But if the food volume is pretty high, or is that a good spot, they probably don't need to bulk their stool more, which is what soluble fiber and insoluble fiber is going to do. It could probably make them more constipated. So I would look at food volume. And if I were to say, okay, food volume's okay, they're getting 25 grams of fiber through their food every day, you probably don't need fiber. What's the next thing that could be causing constipation? My head always goes into like acid production issues. So maybe your stomach acid is insufficient. That's really common to then drive constipation and motility issues. So then I would address that. And the way I would do that is like utilizing some pepsin, some betaine, and seeing if that helps your constipation. And if it does, then great. We probably found the root cause of what was the issue. Now, if that weren't going to, I would then start to dig a little bit deeper and see if, you're getting bloated really quickly after eating. If you are, then there's probably some bigger problem with your digestive tract as to why you're so constipated. But that's usually where I would start. Now, from like a nutrition intervention point, I think kiwi is really helpful for constipation. Like two a day can help a lot with constipation and alleviating it. I'm a really big fan of like senna-based teas. Like senasoids are really good for, they're really good for a constipation as like a stimulative laxative. So they can like stimulate your intestines to contract. And that can help pass like stool that's been sitting for quite some time. Peppermint gel caps are also really useful, or peppermint oil even by itself can help a lot. It has antispasmatic, so it helps stop the spasms in the intestines that are associated with constipation, and that can help you pass the bowel movement a little bit easier as well. And then from like a supplemental side, I probably also would consider Saccharomyces balderi just by itself. It's just a specific strain of a probiotic that's been really found to help with constipation and just overall gut motility. So that would be a really useful like supplement to use in that situation. I also would look at the person's fat intake. I forgot to mention that, but fat intake is where I think some people are scared to eat too much fat because they associate it with body fat for some reason. I mean, I understand why, but they're not really correlated like that. So, fat intake is also a big reason why a lot of people are constipated. So I would look into that. Seasonings, if you're eating too much garlic, too much onion powders, that I've seen that destroy people's stomachs and make them really bloated, really constipated. Artificial sweeteners. So, I mean, your biggest culprit, in my opinion, is gum, especially when you're dieting. You could be chewing way too much gum. Some people have like a really laxative effect to that, or some people have a really constipated effect to that. So just depending on how you break down sugar alcohols is going to see kind of how that impacts you. So those would be some of the things that I would start to look into first. If
I
I thought about
really
it more, I could talk probably like 2 hours on this.
No, that was some great points already. I like that you mentioned that too much fiber is not necessarily a good thing either. I often see that when especially women that are afraid of weight gain, et cetera, come to us and they eat almost too clean and like a ton, like a huge bowl of whatever salad, for lunch and cabbage and whatnot, and it's all just like clogging up their digestive
Yep.
system. So that's what I often see, and it in those cases sometimes is not necessarily a matter of reducing overall fiber, but finding a better balance, a better source, or a better a way to almost cook it or process it, perhaps also. Yeah, that was the first thing that came to mind for me. And then on this on the fat side, could you just clarify if you mean that if we're consuming too low of a fat intake,
Yeah, too low of a fat intake. Yeah.
gotcha. Yeah, I would agree
Yeah,
with
too low of fat intake could lead to constipation. Too much fat intake could lead to diarrhea or like really watery stool.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think especially also again, if we're coming from like maybe the 90s with that super low fat diet kind of approach, we can absolutely see that from time to time. And other supplements that I tend to sometimes not necessarily recommend, but have used for alleviating just gut issues in general, were glutamine, for instance. Is that something that you work with also?
Yeah, glutamine's been really useful for like intestinal permeability, so like leaky gut style things, where you have like issues with the mucosal lining of the intestines. It can help re repair that. I didn't want to go down into a rabbit hole, so.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of, to say to that. I have also heard, I've never experienced or experimented with that, but I also heard that L-carnitine in a higher dose can sometimes help if we're like really constipated. So like 2 grams or 3 grams of L-carnitine, but I don't know. I have not tried that. So anyone listening, don't go ahead and just try that.
That's interesting. I take 2 grams a day, and
Okay.
I don't have any. I would assume that would cause digestive issues, so I haven't had any digestive problems. But that's interesting. I've never heard of that.
Okay, well, I will ask the person because he owns a supplement company as well, so I'll ask
I'm into, yeah, that's, I'm curious about that. That's interesting.
him. Okay, well, very, very good. And I mean, do you see increased digestive issues with competitors? I mean, I don't know what your approach is with them in terms of flexibility in their nutrition, or if they're following like a pretty strict plan.
To be honest, I think the digestive problem is seen across the board, and I would associate that with the person's level of stress.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I have the mom with 5 kids. She's just as constipated as the competitor who's dieting really hard, has 2 jobs. And I've always seen whoever's got the highest stress load has the worst digestion. And it's like, it's almost 9 out of 10 times. So I would say, like, I couldn't even tell because I have competitors right now telling me my digestion's great. I'm competing in a week. I feel amazing. I use the bathroom 3 times a day. And they're good. And then I have people who can't poop for a week. But then I have the mom who is stressed out of her mind because school's starting and she's now backed up this whole week. So I would say the biggest correlation I see is stress level.
This is actually a really important point. Like, honestly, anyone listening, also, especially my clients, underline that, highlight that in your auditory mind, because I mean, we say that as coaches, like, hey, your stress is a big impactor, so we don't need to change anything else, just work on your stress management. But I think it's just always helpful to hear that from various coaches or other people as
Yeah.
well.
Yeah, your stress load is the biggest like cascade driver for a lot of things.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time, Dominic. Honestly, it's been a pleasure picking your brain on all things supplement and training and digestion and whatnot. I am most certainly going to drop all your handles in the show notes, and people go and check out Revive and Raw and Relive Nutrition as well to see what good stuff they have on there, and of course what's in the works. And thank you just for coming on and speaking with
Thank
us.
you. Thank you for having me on.
It's been a true pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dominic. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. And one more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner, Fat & Muscle Project, has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.